Good morning, and thank you all for coming this morning to join us for the launch of the CSIS Commission on Smart Global Health Policy. I'm Steve Morrison. I'm the Senior Vice President here at CSIS and Director of the Global Health Policy Center. I want to first thank many of the staff here who put this together. My close colleague, Lisa Carty, a career diplomat and global health expert, is with us today, joined us at the beginning of the year and has been very instrumental in trying to map out the approach that we've taken and put together the framework that we will hear about today. Suzanne Brundage has had a lead organizing role in putting everything together today, aided by Karen Meacham, Emily Poster, Danielle Porter, and Catherine Streifel, and Anine Hageman, and thanks to all of them. I want to also mention that there are a number of papers that were issued that were related to the work of this commission that have been papers that have been commissioned over the last several months that have been posted. There's a notice that describes these. We have papers by two of our commissioners. Chris Elias, the president, CEO of PATH, wrote one on policies and practices to advance global health technologies, an excellent piece, which I hope you'll look at. Michael Merson, along with his colleague Kim Page, Mike is one of our commissioners, wrote a paper on the dramatic expansion of university engagement in global health. Please look at that. A number of other experts who work closely with us have written quite compelling papers, two on security. Harvey Feldbaum from CICE, from Johns Hopkins, wrote on U.S. global health and national security policy. Jean Bonventre on national security and public and global health. It's an overview of U.S. military programs and assets. Jennifer Cook, the CSIS Africa Program Director, has written an excellent paper on Africa. And Catherine Bliss from our Americas Program has done something similar, a review of Latin America and the Caribbean, and I urge you to look at those. We operate as an institution, as a center in our global health work, very close alliance with the Kaiser Family Foundation and with Jennifer Cates, Diane Rowland, Alicia Carbow. We had talked a few months ago about trying to get to bring forward a good baseline narrative that described U.S. programs, and Kaiser kindly invested quite a bit of effort in putting that together. That's been issued and released today, the U.S. government's global health policy architecture, structure, programs, and fundings. It's on the Kaiser Family Foundation website. It's an excellent new addition analytically, and we're very grateful to that work, and we intend to make a full and ample use of that, and we will continue in very close partnership with the Kaiser Family Foundation as we move forward. We're very excited about this initiative, about this commission on smart global health policy. As you'll see from the list of commissioners and as you'll hear today from the seven commissioners who have agreed to join us, and those include our two co-chairs, Admiral Fallon and Helene Gayle. It includes Congressman Keith Ellison, who's with us today. It includes Chris Elias from PATH, Margie McGlynn, the president of Global Vaccines and Infectious Diseases from Merck, Michael Merson, the director of the Global Health Institute at Duke University, and Patricia Mitchell, the president and CEO of the Paley Center for Media. We have assembled a very diverse, very prominent, and impressive group of personalities who are opinion leaders, who are strategic thinkers. We went about assembling this group, deliberately attempting to get the best and the brightest in the global health domain, as fully a third of our constituents' commissioners. And then we reached out deliberately to prominent personalities and strategic thinkers from the foreign policy world, from the security world, from corporate sector, from media, and from Congress. And we have four members from Congress, Senators Snow and Shaheen, Congressman Ellison, who we'll hear from momentarily, and Congresswoman Kay Granger, who has presented us with a draft, with a statement today that Helene will draw from in her comments. This is an exceptional assembly of personalities, and it's an experiment. It's a deliberate effort by us to see if we can mobilize this opinion around trying to have a smarter, more coherent, more long-term and strategic approach on global health. We've got a short timeline. We're going to complete this work by the end of the year and bring it forward with a very concrete action plan. Helene and Bill Fallon will talk more about that. Global health, there's no question, has grown dramatically in the last, and surprisingly, in this decade, to at least $7.5 billion per year, or 30% of U.S. foreign assistance. And if you take, as the Kaiser Family Foundation did, a broader view that encompasses many of the investments made by NIH, by the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and others, that figure rises to over $9.5 billion a year. Either way you do the calculations, the numbers are impressive and full and ample evidence of the degree to which global health has risen as a priority. This is our first major focused effort of this new center, the Commission. It builds on 7 years of work that we've undertaken with many partner experts and institutions over the last 7 years in the work of the CSIS Task Force on HIV/AIDS. It's also heir to the CSIS Commission on Smart Power, which completed its work in 2007. That Smart Power Commission put a special spotlight on the achievements and the future potentiality for global health as an area where we can better the lives of millions and improve the standing in the United States and advance U.S. interests across a multiplicity of areas, from foreign, humanitarian, developmental, security, and diplomatic stakes. So this will be our priority, and we'll hear more today from Helene and Bill and from our commissioners on the roundtables, from Congressman Ellison, about some of the key things that are in front of us, like how do we achieve higher efficiencies, how do we innovate more strategically, how do we improve our diplomacy to get better leverage out of U.S. influence multilaterally. There are a multitude of other questions that will come forward. Let me just quickly say a few words about Helene and about Bill. Helene Gayle is known to many of you as among the foremost American leaders in global health. She's the president and CEO of CARE. She's a trustee at CSIS. She's a close friend and mentor and an inspiration to many of us who have known her throughout her very distinguished career. She is a doctor. She's a public health expert. She had a distinguished leadership positions at CDC. She became an assistant surgeon general and rear admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service. I didn't realize until this morning that we were going to have two admirals on this panel. She was the director of the TB, HIV, and reproductive health programs at the Gates Foundation during its early, rather remarkable ascent in the first part of this decade. Bill Fallon, we are very grateful to someone of such a long and distinguished military career as the former commander of the U.S. Central Command at a critical time, as the commander of the Pacific Command immediately prior to that during the period of the tsunami and many complex other developments in Asia. Bill Fallon came to this issue with an open mind. It wasn't, he will describe that we had to really engage and begin to take on the number of probing questions that come naturally when you ask a four-star admiral to come to CSIS and talk about global health. We had to make the case, and we're very grateful that he's been willing to take this on. It's very important that we have this mix, this particular blend of expertise and perspectives across a span of security, development, humanitarian, and health-based special expertise as we attempt to look forward and chart the course for this next phase of the U.S. engagement on global health. So please join me in honoring and welcoming Bill and Helene as they walk us through this. Following that, Bill Fallon, Admiral Fallon, will introduce our Congressman Ellison to deliver his remarks and take some questions and answers, and then we'll move into the second half of our program, which involves two quick roundtables engaging our other commissioners here. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve, and to all of your team for the real leadership in moving this forward. I'm really excited to be here and to be part of this. I'd like to also acknowledge, as Steve did, the commissioners who are with us today, Pat Mitchell, Margie McGlynn, Chris Elias, and Mike Merson, and Congressman Ellison. We couldn't do this without your efforts and without the commitment of your time. If you look at the list, we have a very distinguished list of commissioners, people who have lots of other things on their plate, but they are here because they're here. Some are here today in person, and others have signed up to this because of the high priority that I think people do put attached to this issue. You know, as somebody, as Steve mentioned, this is what I've been doing most of my life, and it's very easy to take for granted that this is an issue that that is important to those of us working in global health. But I think it's particularly gratifying when you see the list of people who are not global health professionals, who have not spent their life working on this, who feel like this is an issue whose time has come, and they want to spend the kind of time and commitment to it. And it's why I'm also very pleased to have Bill Fallon as my co-chair in this effort. I think it does represent that we really do, this is a unique moment in history for a lot of reasons. And, you know, we all throw around these terms, moment in history. But I really do think that we have some real opportunities here in ways that we have not had before. You know, first and foremost, the fact that there is a recognition of the importance of this issue. But as Steve mentioned in his opening comments, you know, we do have unprecedented resources. I often mention that when I was heading USAID's AIDS program, my budget at that time for the global AIDS program was $250 million. We just reauthorized a bill for $50 billion of expenditure on HIV. So, you know, I think just as one example, it shows that we do have unprecedented resources in way like we never have had before. We have a real opportunity with a administration that has made global issues and global health a priority, building on the foundation that the last administration already committed, again, with some of the resources, whether PEPFAR, President's Malaria Initiative, et cetera. But I think, you know, as always, the transition in an administration gives opportunities to look at something in a new and fresh way, and I think this administration has the opportunity, again, to build on some resources and commitment that had not been there previously. I also think this is a time where we do recognize that resources aren't everything. And given the fact that we have resources, this is a time for us to think about how do we use them in a better and smarter way. How can we, in a time when we know we are facing economic challenges, look at what resources we do have and use them in a way that can have the greatest opportunity for making a difference. And so I think this commission wants to step back, look at this in a fresh new way, look at what we resources we have, the foundation we have, the years of experience that we have to build on, and look at how do we do it bigger, how do we do it better, smarter, and take advantage of what we already as lessons that we can learn. So we want to ask a few questions. And I'm sure that you will come up with many more that will be useful. How does the U.S. capitalize on its current investments? What should we be doing more of? What can we be doing differently? And I think we want to ask those questions in a very open way, in a way that doesn't box us into just how we've done things before. How do we do a better job of measuring impacts and determining clearly what works, but also equally what doesn't work, and being willing to say that we don't have to worry about only saying what have we done well and talk about our successes, but we're equally willing to look at our failures and be rigorous about examining them. How do we achieve greater efficiencies across current programs? all of us who work in the field know the duplicating of of efforts that often goes on in the field. And I think it's one of the things that is the outgrowth of having more resources. It also means that you've got more actors in the field. And how can we do a better job of rationalizing what we do across the many agencies? And while we're going to focus a lot of our efforts on, not surprisingly, how do we influence the policy environment here in Washington, we don't want to neglect the broader field of actors who are now in global health. And, you know, again, one of the fortunate things is that we have many private sector resources also flowing into this. So I think we want to look at this in a way that looks more broadly at all the actors, and then what's the way that the policy environment here can influence that. And, you know, how do we look for the issue? How do we look at the issue of sustainability? It's something we talk about all the time, but I think it's something we don't really truly wrestle with in ways that allow us to say that we can look back in 20 years later, the efforts that we have put in this have not vanished, and we really have looked at a way of looking at a much longer-term view of what we do. And I think today's economic situation makes us think even more seriously about the issue of sustainability. And then I think, how do we work more smartly with others? And that's both within the U.S. and the range of actors, but also how can we be better actors with the whole global community and look at what our comparative advantage is as the U.S. and really take and really use that for the greatest good. You know, I think I will just end. I want to, before I end, just read a little bit from the statement that Congresswoman Granger left us, but just to say finally that I think, you know, people ask why now. There have been a lot of reports. There's been a lot of focus on this, and I just acknowledge Patrick Kelly, who's here from the Institute of Medicine. The Institute of Medicine is finalizing a major review on global health. The Smart Power Commission, as Steve mentioned, had issues related to the broader issue of global foreign policy, global development, and global health, as well as global health. But I think this is a time where this approach, which is somewhat different from those two, can build on those but look differently. We have made one of our greatest investments as a government in global health, and if we look at the dollars that flow for global development overall, global health is our single, other than military, is our single biggest foreign assistance activity. And so I think it is an important time for us to look at that and examine. So, you know, for all these reasons, I think this is an opportune time. I think we've got an incredible group of people pulled together. We look forward to hearing from all of you today, but also we hope to keep you engaged in the future as we continue to think about how to make this report and this commission be useful to all of us in our different endeavors. And let me just close by reading a little bit from the statement from Congresswoman Kay Granger, who couldn't be with us today but wanted us to know that she is really, really engaged in this effort. And she said, "I want to thank you for inviting me to participate in this important effort. I'm sorry I couldn't be here in person. Healthcare issues have always been important, so it's an honor to serve on this commission. Serving on this commission is a real opportunity to find solutions that will have an impact on a global level." She goes on to talk about some of the successes in areas that we've already worked on, whether it's pandemic influenza, the HIV prevention and treatment efforts in the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. And she talks about her own personal travels to South Africa and how she was able to understand firsthand some of the real challenges that are presented in real-world situations. She says, "This is the sort of thing that this commission needs to review to make sure we're using our resources in the way that makes the most sense." So I think a lot of the things that I've mentioned already are the kinds of things that resonate. How do we take what we know, look at our experience, build on the very successful things that the U.S. government has already been able to do, but look at that in a different way and in a smarter way? In closing, she just says, "Thank you again for this exciting opportunity and look forward to working with all of you over the years." And we're just pleased to have not only her presence Congressman Ellison that you'll be hearing from, but also Senator Olympia Snowe and Jean Shaheen. So we have both key policymakers as a part of this commission, as well as the broad range of people from a variety of sectors. And I will just, again, thank all of you for being here. We look forward to your incredible participation throughout this effort, and turn it over to my co-chair, Bill Fallon. And thanks again for being here.
Dr. Gale, thank you very much, and welcome, Congressman Ellison, distinguished members of the commission, with your incredibly busy schedules to take time to actually come to Washington and be with us this morning is really a great sign of your desire to be a part of what I think is going to be a very, very interesting and hopefully impactful piece of work. And to this very, very large audience, I'm looking at standing room only. I was up in Boston the other night at Fenway Park to the home opener, and the fans were standing up on the monster and other places, and I think you've got them beaten. So really delighted to see everybody here. You know, you might ask, as Steve said, so what's this old admiral doing up here? What's he know about global health? And the answer is not enough, but I'm learning. But I will give you a perspective, and that is I spent an awful lot of time, many decades, around the world engaged in various activities, and most of them typically involved cleaning up broken China or digging us out of holes that we managed to find ourselves in, and very necessary work, and we're very blessed to have so many people in this country willing to help. But I thought many times how it might be different, and how if we spent a little bit more time investing in the preventive end of business and taking care of things that I think could be fixed or made better with a relatively modest investment, that maybe we'd find ourselves in a place position we might like. And so I'm delighted to be able to join Dr. Gale with her distinguished background and in service to mankind and to the many other people who have volunteered their time to come together to work. And why now? And it seems to me that we do have a great opportunity. Expectations are incredibly high. As I get around the world today and see people are enthusiastic, they're renewed with a sense of the art of the possible. And the idea here is to see what we can do to fulfill some of those expectations, and to try and capitalize on this enthusiasm to actually build a foundation to get something done. Now, this is not going to be easy work, as I'm discovering, because people like instant results. They like to see things happen right now. And this is an area that's going to require some significant planning and some thoughtful discussion and some prioritization and then some real work to get this done. But I think we have an opportunity, and let's see what we can do to take advantage of it. It strikes me that it'll take a while. We're not giving ourselves a whole lot of time here to come up with a way ahead. But in terms of implementation, a lot of these challenges have been with us in the world for a long time, and they're not going to be solved overnight. But we know how to do many of the things that could make things better. And it's a matter, it seems to me, of getting the priorities right, finding the right people to pull together and to take advantage of this tremendous interest in making things better. As I look at our country and the immense resources and blessings that we happen to enjoy, and, in fact, behaviors, we in this nation have been incredibly generous. We are the world's largest donor in health assistance to the world. The sums of money are very large, in the order of $10 billion this past year alone, which is almost double the previous year. And so this is a good trend. There's a lot we can do. But as I look at the way we've been addressing these issues, it's fragmented. And frankly, one of the things that we would expect to do as we get into this work is to take a look at just what we're doing and how we've been doing it and see if there may not be some more efficient ways to leverage our investments and the incredible interest and desire and work that people do to come up with some better long-term results, and ones that are going to be helpful not only to people in the health world, but also to our country. Frankly, people look to this country with its many blessings and capabilities to help around the world. And we can fulfill some of those expectations, and I think we can do it in a manner that that might be perceived a little bit better and would help us. As I look back on the years that I spent trying to work in the business of security and stability, fundamental to security these days is basic day-to-day existence for people, how they relate to themselves, to their families, to their environments. And these seemingly small things actually are the building blocks for stability and security. As I was a young officer growing up in the business that I spent 40 years plus doing, it seemed to me that security was pretty well defined in the business of state actors, this country versus this, and borders, and of course, the Cold War, and so forth. I think that today, security is perceived to be much more of a personal thing, and health is clearly a major ingredient to that. And so what we're about is to try to see what we can do to build on what we know works, and we have an awful lot of knowledge. Dr. Gale and her colleagues in the medical professions have spent their lives figuring this stuff out, working towards new solutions, and frankly, I think most of them are already pretty well in hand. We just have to figure out how to get them exported and into places that that need them and to get results. And I'll end on that with that term. My interest in being here, and Dr. Gale and I discovered very quickly that we share a mutual objective, and that is to come up with some results. And so that's what we're really about. We are grateful for the wonderful, diverse participation of so many commissioners from around the country with their incredible backgrounds and experiences, and we hope to leverage that experience to come up with some results that will be beneficial to our country and to people in the world. So thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. And let me shift gears for a minute, if I could. Much prefer to stand up and walk around. I have a special pleasure this morning. Dr. Gale mentioned that we are particularly blessed to have four distinguished members of the Congress and the Senate. You'll notice it's a bipartisan group. It's a diverse in many respects, and that is to our benefit and to the benefit of those who we think will leverage what we hope to do here. We're particularly honored today to have Congressman Keith Ellison, who has come down. Some of you have a sense of the schedules. I think I have maybe a pretty keen sense of what demands are on their days and nights. They're incessant. Everybody wants a piece of them for you name it. You look at the hundreds of people here this morning. His constituents are in the many thousands that each like to have a part of his day every day to advance their interests and to listen to their problems and to solve their issues. He has chosen to come and be with us today to share his significant experience despite his young appearance. He has extensive engagement in the world, and he has spent an incredibly large amount of the short time he's been on the Congress out in the world seeing firsthand what's really going on, not taking people's opinions and words, but to actually see for himself to get a really good idea. Congressman Ellison is in his second term, representing the 5th District from Minnesota. That's Minneapolis and some of its neighboring suburbs. Now, he's a native of Detroit, went to Wayne State University. He then found himself going west to Minnesota to law school. He obviously wasn't deterred by forecasts of ice and snow and perpetual winter. He's clearly adapted to it because he's never left. He and his wife, Kim, and their four children have been longtime residents of the state of Minnesota, and now the people of that state are benefiting from his leadership and expertise on the Hill. His background is in the legal business. He was an attorney for a decade and a half. Then he got into politics and served in the state legislature for a couple of terms, and then has moved down to the national scene where he's rapidly making a name for himself because of his interest, his dedication, his diligence that he brings to these matters, and it's our particularly great honor to have you with us. Congressman Ellison, please come up here and join us, and thanks for sharing your time.
Thank you, Admiral Fallon, for that very generous introduction. Let me also thank Mr. John Hammer, who's the president and CEO of CSIS, for this great initiative, Admiral Fallon, and Dr. Gale. Thank you for your leadership on this important effort. And also let me thank our fellow commissioners, friends, colleagues, and all the distinguished guests who are here. What a pleasure it is to be part of this important work, this launch of a Global Health Policy Center. I'm honored to be part of this excellent initiative, and I look forward to participating. I was motivated to join the commission because of three essential reasons. The first reason is it's simply the right thing to do. No matter what faith tradition you might pick or pluck out, all faith traditions agree that health and wellness and well-being are an essential component of a good life. And so to be part of this effort is very gratifying to me. You know, in a world where over a billion people live on less than a dollar a day, where about 1.6 billion live on less than $2 a day, knowing how tightly poverty is connected to poor health and how tightly poverty is connected to political instability, I think that there are very few things we could do more important than refine, enhance, and develop our approach to global health. The second reason that I'm so happy to be part of this effort is that I think the United States and the people of the United States have so much great potential to do so much good. We've seen examples of success in recent years. For example, I think it's important to point out that the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, has been successful, particularly in Africa. And in my limited travels there, I've heard good reports as well as anecdotally and statistically. And also numerous efforts to fight malaria, tuberculosis. We have the strength and assets to bring the financial capital, human capital, scientific knowledge, institutional readiness to lead efforts on a global scale. And I believe that given the importance of the United States as a nation in this global neighborhood and community, we can also leverage the efforts of other nations and other entities by our example. So I think it's so essential that we embark on this important effort. Global health is an important instrument of smart power. It enhances our standing in the world by making the lives of citizens better who would otherwise suffer from disease and poor health care. Better diplomacy brings happiness, well-being, and a more friendly attitude toward our great nation. Helps our nation to reflect what it's truly about by helping people live better, higher quality of life. And when we look home and abroad, we see that investment in health is an indispensable condition for stability and prosperity. And, of course, it's the morally right thing to do. You know, it's also important to point out that during times of economic downturn, like we're facing now, lowering poor countries tend to face health care budget cuts and decrease in foreign aids. These worsening conditions are the very factors that breed political instability. And we know from our experience back in 1978 and 1982, for example, during that recession, that investment in health sectors were slashed in many developing countries, and that caused political retrogression. We cannot afford to repeat that mistake because we now know that poor health and poverty are closely related, and poverty and political instability are interconnected. I'm a member of the House Financial Services Committee and Foreign Affairs Committee. I see my work on both of these committees as related to each other. I see the work that I'm doing on both of these committees as connecting the United States' place in the world as well as our economic place in the world and health position in the world. And I believe that we should continue to focus on the Millennium Development Goals as guiding platforms in reducing global poverty and closing global health gaps. The three MDGs that focus on improving child and maternal health and fighting infectious diseases should form the core of our global health objectives. We've made significant progress in fighting and controlling AIDS, but we're not done. Tuberculosis and malaria still serious challenges to global health. There's room for improvement in maternal health care, significant room for improvement there, as well as child health. And I believe that this commission could contribute to enhancing U.S. leadership in these areas. I also want to stress that I hope that the commission focuses on mental health. And because as you look around the globe and you look at conflict, there's no doubt that it has a very serious impact on the mental health of people who experience that conflict. I was recently in the Gaza Strip, and I was also recently in Sderot, which is a town in Israel outside the Gaza Strip. And when we talked to healthcare professionals in both areas, both stressed how children are impacted by the conflict and how children in both areas experience nightmares, bedwetting, hypersensitivity to sound, to light, phobias of all kinds. And it's these conditions do not bode well for the future if we don't address them. Global health may seem a distant thing for some people, but of course you and I know that it's not. In my own district of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the surrounding areas, we have seen conflict around the world express itself right in the district. We have a very large Somali population, Hmong population, Liberian population, Tibetan population, as well as other, and all of these communities face health conditions that are related to the condition that brought them to live in our midst and to become Minnesotans among us. We know that these conditions that led to their need to depart their country also have health implications in the country of their origin and for their well-being in the United States and in Minnesota. So I believe that it's critical that we understand the interconnection between what happens in the rest of the world and what happens right here at home. Of course, we are part of the rest of the world. So we need to work on strategies that bring together and match capacity of different sectors, university, biotechnology, businesses, NGOs, hospitals, religious institutions, and I think it's important to embrace that as an important asset in our approach, and policymakers. We need new skills, knowledge, and investment, global partnerships to implement global health policy that sustains the U.S. contribution and lead in the world. I hope to use the Commission's deliberations and findings to inform my work and the Congress's work in the important foreign aid reform debate that's going on right now. There has not been a reauthorization of the relevant legislation since 1985, and so right now is a great time to be involved in the conversation to help inform our policy work going forward. Opportunities are in front of us to make global health policy more efficient, more transparent, more accountable, and most importantly, we can make it a tool for public diplomacy, especially in light of the ongoing conflicts in Somalia, Gaza, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Darfur, and I could keep going. I will participate in the commission to bring forward actionable ideas to place to these places, and I'm certain that Americans also stand to benefit from a better global health care and better U.S. global health policy. Again, thank you. I'm very pleased to be a part of the commission.
We do have an opportunity for questions or comments from the audience. If anybody would like to start off, please. How does that work?
I'm Stephen Alderman from the Peter C. Alderman Foundation. We train indigenous doctors and healthcare personnel to treat their own populations in post-conflict countries around the world. To deal with traumatic depression. My question is this. There's a large evidence base that documents the enormous effect that mental health has on the deliverance of global health. WHO has reported that 1 billion people have been directly impacted by mass violence. War-caused depression and other problems accounts for greater than 30% of the global burden of disease. That means in post-conflict countries, up to a third of people are affected by PTSD and traumatic depression. Yet the dirty little secret is there is no representation for mental health by global health funders. This leaves post-conflict countries inundated by the problems, and as such, they're unable to handle it. In the pursuit of a smart strategy, has anybody, Congressman, thank you so much, by the way, really, has anybody thought to include this problem? Thanks.
Well, Doctor, thank you for your observation. As I noted in my remarks, I think it's essential that we address issues of mental and emotional well-being. And I agree with you that we cannot simply have a patron-client relationship as we try to address the issue of global health. Indigenous doctors and healthcare professionals have to be part of the solution, must be part of the solution. And if they're traumatized by war and conflict, and if their patients are, and if the nurses and doctors and the whole healthcare apparatus in the country is somehow weakened by mental health challenges, obviously our efforts are going to be much less effective than they could be. So that's why I made the comments that I made. I think it's got to be part of our delivery. Now, let me also say, too, that, you know, here in the United States, it almost feels like we're just now coming to grips with the importance of addressing mental and emotional health. I mean, we just passed the Paul Wellstone Mental Health Parity Act just recently. And we're now just addressing funding mental health on par with other physical ailments. So I guess we need to work together as we learn the lessons ourselves. We need to share that and need to bear it in mind. And I'm glad you made the point you did. I'm sure it'll be part of the work.
And maybe people can just line up at the microphone for this. Oh, thank you. For this segment, and this is question specifically to the congressman, because we will have time afterwards in the roundtable to address more broad questions. And so maybe we can just take those who are currently there, and then we're going to move on to the roundtables.
Sure. Hi, my name is Jed Moline. I'm a advisor for health at USAID, and I wanted to, first of all, thank CSIS and Steve Morrison for pulling this panel together. I think in the plethora of work that's been going on in foreign aid reform, there has been somewhat of a policy gap in looking at how we can be more efficient with our investments in global health, and I kudos to all of you for doing this. Thank you, Congressman, for joining, and Admiral Fallon, I wanted to say it was a pleasure to work with you on tsunami relief when I was at the White House as well. But my question is kind of to Dr. Gale. You raised, and I was very heartened to hear you raise, the issue of sustainability. And I found in our investments, the U.S. government's investments in global health, that there's this tension, almost a King Solomon tension, if you will, between international public health and international health development. Is our investment to save a life today or build the capacity to save 10 lives tomorrow? And there's this tension, and it's a terrible tension. And policymakers at the Hill, through Washington agencies, down through implementers in the field have to balance this act, and call it sustainability, call it health diplomacy versus stability. There's many different ways to slice the same question, I'm encouraged to hear you say it. I'd like to hear you maybe explain a little bit more how you plan to look at that issue, because I think it's critical to what people expect from our health investments and how we implement them and where we go with this. I think it's actually one of the fundamental questions, this international health public health versus international health development.
Yeah, and I'll just answer very briefly because I would like us to, while we have the congressman here, have opportunities for questions specifically. But, you know, I think it is a long-standing tension, but I don't think it necessarily needs to be an either-or. I think that there are ways to be able to measure short-term impacts but have longer-term goals. And, you know, one of the things that I think we haven't done well enough is to think long-term for a lot of reasons, including how our budgets are done and budget cycles. You know, our programs tend to focus a lot more on immediate outcomes. And I don't think that's bad. I think immediate outcomes give people a sense of accomplishment, and there are some things that we do that the immediacy is important. On the other hand, I think if we're not looking longer term, then this issue of sustainability and real impact won't be realize. So I think this is something we're going to grapple with. And just, you know, just a word, because to say where we are in this process, we are. This is the launch. We don't have a report in our back pockets that we really have already written. And so these are the kinds of questions we'll be grappling with. We don't have the answers today, and are not going to be able to give you precise answers. And so thoughts that you have about issues that we ought to be raising, questions that you have, will be very useful. But we don't have the answers in our back pocket or the report already written. This is a real effort to have a broad look at this issue. So,
thank you.
I'm Raghubir Goyal from India Globe and Asia Today. Nice program, very educational, Congressman. The question is that world's largest democracy, India, how do you see that they are in this health crisis as far as your study is concerned? And if you are working with the United Nations World Health Organization and also Clinton Foundation, both are involved in global health crisis. And Congressman, if you're planning anything on the Capitol Hill, and how this study will be taken by the Obama administration?
Well, unfortunately, I have to punt on that excellent question. Again, the commission's beginning its work. This is a launch. But I do anticipate a few things. One is that the administration will pay close attention to the findings and the analysis in the report. There are four legislators on the commission, so there's no doubt that the Congress will be able to transmit the findings into an opportunity to make some policy. I can foresee presentations on the Hill. I can foresee things like that. We don't have any dates or plans yet, but I think those things are within the realm of the possibility. And obviously, India, you know, is an indispensable player in the world community. So I'm sure that there will be conversation and focus in and around issues that impact India. So, and of course, we'll be raising these critical issues, and so it'll be part of the dialogue, I think. Beyond that,
and the only thing I'd add is that the idea here is to come up with recommendations for a U.S. global health policy. But clearly, in the context of these other organizations, from the UN through the various NGOs that are out there functioning, we're going to be casting the nets wide to see what's out there in the realm of ideas and activities that have been ongoing, and then try to put that in some context that makes sense nationally. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm Mehtab Karim after India. I'm from Pakistan. Originally from Pakistan. I thank Congressman Ellison for bringing very important issue about mental health of women and children in conflict zones. I was working as a professor and head of reproductive health program at Aga Khan University in Pakistan for the last 10 years, and nowadays I'm here on my sabbatical doing a book. We did a survey as a part of, I worked for NIH in the 90s, and part of my job was to do a big survey in what is known as FATA. It was rarely known then in the 90s, and NWFP, looking at the maternal and infant health in the region. And what is there now was perhaps, it appears in that report which we did, that maternal mortality rate was very high, too many children, on average about 7, and now they have grown up. You know, they are the ones who are causing problems for Pakistan and for all other countries. I don't want to name all of them. So that's where we have to look at what's happening in the conflict zones. Unfortunately, Pakistan's family planning program has not been very successful as compared to, for example, in Bangladesh and Iran and many other countries. And I think that's where we have to look at the reproductive health of women and their children and young people. I mean, what options they have. And I think that's an issue which the commission must address,
right. Well,
not
thanks.
Only in Pakistan, yeah. But many other countries.
Thank
you very much.
Thanks for the input. And we're going to try to answer the give these folks that are standing the opportunity to ask a question, and then we're going to try and move on. Sir.
Yes, David Bryden with the Infectious Disease Society of America. And I just wanted to come to Congressman Ellison with a question. Based on your visit to Gaza and interest in greater partnership with Muslim countries and peace and stability. Looking at the phrase smart global health policy, I'm concerned that that not automatically translate into get used to flatline budgets on global health, get used to scarcity in global health dollars, because to really be smart, we need to put money behind smart global health policy. Particularly when we looked at these Muslim countries like Pakistan, which we've heard about, the biggest infectious disease killer there is tuberculosis. And I recently met with the Minister of Health of Pakistan. He said, focus on TB. That would be a way to partner with Muslim countries. And yet we don't see any money for TB or global health in the defense supplemental. So I'm wondering if that's something that you'd be concerned about.
It is something I'm concerned about. And, you know, I've taken notes as to your observation, and they will form the part of our deliberation. And so thank you for making that point.
And lest there be a misinterpretation or misunderstandings here, the business of SMART, the use of that term is to not just be some kind of a sleight of hand here to ease into some reduction, far be it from what we're about. We are trying to look at the entire approach to global health in every aspect that makes sense and to come up with some recommendations. And believe me, if we were really smart, I doubt that we would sit down and craft the way that money flows from through the good offices of the Congress the way it's done today through 7 different cabinet positions, 3 independent agencies, dozens of other – get the picture? So lots of –
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm the president of Hope for Tomorrow. I focus on African immigrants communities here in Washington, D.C., especially women. I want to thank Dr. Helen, Kale, and the CSI president and the Congress. My concern is I'm happy the congressman spoke about the immigrants who live in Minnesota, Somali, Liberians. We have a problem with African immigrants who live in the U.S. They don't have health care, maybe most of them because they don't have starters, and it has been very, very difficult to talk about it. And I raised this at the Congress last year, but I never got any response on how they can be supported to get health care, especially women when it comes to HIV/AIDS. People are only looking at HIV/AIDS, but we have other issues like cervical cancer, breast cancer. I have helped so many African women here on my own trying to get to hospital. So I would really, really appreciate Congress to look into this, how immigrants can get health care in the United States, and also looking at Africa. I come from Kenya, and many times I've traveled in many African countries. We still have an issue and problems of malaria and children and women issues as I'm talking. But the people concerned or on health care have not reached the rural areas. We have people in the rural areas who really suffer from malaria. Clinics don't have nets. I once one time asked the foundation to help me, United Nations, with nets. They say, you know, Kenya, it will be given nets in 2010. So 2010, what about now? Malaria is killing. Where I come from is where malaria is affected. So please look into this. And I'm so happy for this event, Dr. Okay. Kale. And I hope, and I'll come to see you, Mr. Congress, for further discussion. Thank you.
See, everybody wants to be seen.
Well, thank you for your observation as well. I took notes as to what everyone said, and I think, though, I appreciate the tips as to what we should help guide our conversations. Critical, would you say so, Admiral? And I'd also say that, well, let me just say that it's important that we have a robust, candid dialogue, because I do hope that our country can recognize that while it may be politically satisfying on one level to say, you know what, we're only going to give health care to American citizens and we're not going to be as, quote-unquote, generous with immigrants, anytime a child who's been infected by tuberculosis gets on the bus with your kid, you know, It doesn't make sense to have a narrow view of the question. We should have a broad view and look. If the only thing to get us to do the right thing is narrow self-interest, well, then so be it. Hopefully we'll look beyond that. But I do appreciate the comments.
Could I just add one point on that, too? And this is a point that some of our commissioners, especially Mike Merson, makes often. You know, those of us who have been working in this field deliberately went from calling this international health to global health. And I think the comments that the last speaker made are indicative of the fact that we have to grapple with the fact that we are also part of the global world. And as we think about global health, it also has implications for how we're thinking about health within our own borders and how that relates to the rest of the world. So I think it's a point well taken without going into a lot of detail, but it is one we will pay attention to.
Thanks. And this young lady gets to have the last question in this part of the program.
Thank you.
Ma'am?
My name is Sudha Siddhanti, and I'm the director of Discover Swasth, an organization dedicated to using yoga and Ayurveda to teach better physical and mental health. Now, I'm very happy when Dr. Gaylord mentioned about starting this commission with a fresh new perspective. We are blessed to have great funds for our global health policy, but at the same time, we want to use it effectively, more efficiently. So I think complementary and alternative medicine is a key part of the answer. Now, it's something that requires very less investment and great returns in the end, both in physical and mental health. Now, I know a lot of people may not be maybe well-versed in it, so to give one example would be just breathing exercises that would strengthen the immune system, which is great for physical and mental health, many of the diseases that we're talking about today. So I think it's something that should be part of the investment.
Great input. Thank you very much. Okay, well, you've been very kind, and there's clearly lots of interest and no lack of inputs, and so we'll take that as a great sign to kick off. Congressman, thanks very, very much for taking
Thank
time
you all.
With us today. It's been an honor and pleasure.
Okay. We are going to move rapidly into our to the first roundtable. And I will call our participants, Chris Elias and Margie McGlynn, to the podium. And this section talks about the first roundtable is what is global health about today? So I'm pleased to have with us two distinguished health professionals, Chris Elias, who is president of PATH, and Margie McGlynn, who is, your title in Merck is head of vaccine
and infectious disease.
So both who have had in their careers real impact in this area. So pleased to have both of them joining me. And I'm going to ask them a series of questions, have them answer, and then open it up to dialogue with the audience. So let me just start with the very first question to get a sense for where we are today. So if both of you would comment briefly on, at this moment, where do you think the global health agenda stands? And I think it builds on some of the comments that other people have raised. And particularly when we think about the massive expansion of resources that have already been directed in some specific areas. Where are we today? What should our priorities be? And what do you think our overall global health agenda is at this moment? So, Margie, maybe start with you.
Sure, I'd be happy to start. You know, I would echo some of the comments that you opened with, Helene, that we really do have unprecedented level of resources available, and we've come a long way in the last 10 years, especially 20 years. We also have an unprecedented number of stakeholders involved and coalitions forming, and I think some of the best examples we have seen of progress is when that happens. Clearly, there's not enough funding. Clearly, it's not coordinated all of our efforts as well as they need to be. But when you look at what has been accomplished, and I'll cite two examples, you can see how far we've come. One would be PEPFAR. One would be looking at 3 million patients with HIV receiving antiretroviral therapy. And to make that happen, I know being involved in the HIV therapeutic arena is no easy feat. Making sure that you have the ability to deliver that health care in these settings is no easy feat. So 3 million is an impressive number, but that's not even one-tenth of the number of people living with HIV today. And unfortunately, there are almost as many people getting infected, newly infected, every year. So while we've made great progress, we've only scratched the surface. The second example I'll give is in the world of vaccines, which I'm certainly very involved in the role that I lead for Merck. If you were to come out with a new vaccine 10, 15, 20 years ago, even if you were willing to give that vaccine away to everyone who needs it in the developing world, where the need is even greater for vaccines because of the lack of healthcare infrastructure and even sanitary conditions, you wouldn't have been able to do so. There was just no feasible infrastructure that existed. And Gavi has come together as an alliance of key stakeholders, including UNICEF, WHO, World Bank, donors, developing world countries, and now has the ability to approve vaccination programs, to utilize donor funds, but most importantly, to be able to implement those programs. Tremendous success has been achieved with immunization programs like hepatitis B, many new programs rolling out through Gavi and others to follow as additional funding is secured. So I think what we have seen occur thus far should give us hope for the future, but should tell us that our job has really just started because we have so much further to go.
Thanks, Bruce. I would echo some of those comments. I think, you know, as I was thinking about this question in preparation for today, I thought about how is the global health scene different today than it was a decade ago? There's really kind of three things that came to mind. One is that if you look at the pipeline of new innovation of affordable health technologies to help solve some of the biggest global health problems, we have a completely different situation today than a decade ago. Beginning about a decade ago, the U.S. government, other governments, the Gates Foundation, other foundations began to invest in solutions, new tools and technologies to solve some of these problems. And if you look at the pipelines of the product development partnerships, you see that we have lots of new drugs, vaccines, diagnostics coming to fruition. Some are already here, some are imminent. Others we've made substantial progress on, everything from some of the vaccines that Margie works on and rotavirus and HPV to important new progress in vaccines for malaria and other areas. So we have, over the last decade, invested in and developed the fattest pipeline of new innovation for global health that we've had in a long time. That's one important achievement. Second, we have rallied, as several people have referred to, considerable new financial resources, but even more importantly, a broader and stronger political coalition to support and sustain those resource commitments. If you look at the statements of the G8 in the last several years compared to a decade ago when health was not mentioned, we've managed to recruit many other people to understanding these issues and the need for sustained attention to solving these problems. Many things that the Admiral and the Congressman said about how global health is linked to broader security and development concerns, et cetera. The third thing that's happened, partly as a consequence of that political and financial commitment, is that we have begun to redimension our expectations for what should be happening. So if you reflect on some of the things that Margie mentioned about new pieces of global health architecture, the Global Alliance of Vaccines and Immunization is 10 years old this year, Gavi. The Global Fund for AIDS to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria is less than 10 years old. PEPFAR is a new program of the last decade. And through those programs, we've seen the needle move, not all the way, but we've gone from less than 5% of people in Africa who needed antiretroviral treatment 5 years ago to about 30 or 35%. That's considerable progress. So I think that we have built, I guess the way I think about it is it's a sort of a fragile success story. And there are a couple of things that we need to do in order to sustain that. One is that we need to identify and measure those successes and communicate them to the broader U.S. population, which largely doesn't realize what's been achieved in the last decade. They still think this is a big unsolvable problem in people that I talk to. we need to then protect, again, through documentation and communication of those results, how do we sustain this momentum through the deepest economic crisis that we've seen in my lifetime? And then finally, how do we use that success as a platform for coming problems? There have been a couple of mentions of mental health, chronic diseases. If you look at the epidemiological trends, while we're making significant progress in infectious disease, maternal and reproductive health, that we've got a coming, growing epidemic of chronic diseases as people adopt unhealthy lifestyles around the world, and we've got to begin to prepare for that. And some of the lessons we've learned in the last decade with infectious diseases are going to help provide the way for thinking about that.
Great. And by the way, I realize in retrospect that I thought Steve had actually given your bios, and I didn't. So just a couple more words about both of our panelists, because in the question and answer, to have a sense of where they all come from. And as I mentioned, Chris Elias heads PATH, which is an organization that works to provide appropriate technologies in developing country settings. PATH works in 70 countries in health technology, maternal and child health, reproductive health, vaccines, immunization, and emerging and epidemic diseases. He has been a leader in global health for many, many, many years, and we've been joined at the hip in many different ventures. And Margie, as I mentioned, is the president of Merck Vaccines and Infectious Diseases for the Merck Company. I'm sure that Merck is a name that is familiar to everybody in this office. In that capacity, she is responsible for leading efforts to commercialize Merck's vaccine and infectious disease products globally. So I just kind of give that, and I could go on and on about their bios, but just for a little bit of perspective where both of our panelists come from. Let me just move from that first question. You kind of touched on it, Chris, but both of you did in your opening statements, but where do you think the biggest achievements have been made, and given that, where do you think we have kind of the toughest challenges and the issues remaining that we might want to think about grappling with?
Yeah, I think taking some of the early wins that we've had and making these programs scalable and making these programs sustainable is a major challenge that we have. And I'm confident that we've got the building blocks in place, but we really have to pull it all together. And I think it was mentioned in the opening session that we can't address these issues in a siloed manner, whether it's infectious disease, whether it's mental health, whether it's safe drinking water. We need to think about how to solve this in an integrated way, and I really think that infrastructure is a major ingredient to do so. And to have a siloed program where you bring in an elderly person or an infant or an adolescent for one sort of intervention and not taking advantage of the opportunity that there are many global health issues that can be addressed in that setting, I think we're missing a huge opportunity. So I really would put on the table as the number one need to address the overall issue of an integrated infrastructure and an approach to make these programs scalable, which that infrastructure will enable, and to make them sustainable, there also has to be a commitment of funding, both continued funding through countries such as ours, but also greater commitment within many of these countries themselves.
Yeah, I think to your question, Helene, we've made the most success where we've shown the brightest spotlight. So in HIV through PEPFAR, through in scale-up of malaria control in places like Ethiopia and Zambia and Rwanda and Zanzibar, lots of examples. Again, a spotlight through the Rollback Malaria and the Malaria No More advocacy and through resources through the President's Malaria Initiative. So where we have shown the light in political commitment and financial resources, we've made considerable progress. The third example would be vaccine-preventable diseases through Gavi. It's interesting to contrast that to places where we haven't shown the light, and it goes to Margie's point of view, a point about the need for an integrated response and health systems approach. So diarrheal disease, where second biggest cause of death of kids under the age of five, has been for a while. Big problem. We have solutions at hand. We haven't shown the light on that and mobilized the same kind of commitments we have for HIV, malaria, vaccine-preventable diseases. Maternal health. probably, you know, our biggest risk for failure in the Millennium Development Goals, around Millennium Development Goal number 5, we really haven't moved the needle in maternal health yet. And that's probably because to do so, there is no simple magic bullet. It really requires the development of an effective and responsive healthcare system. And that's, I guess, my overall concern, is that while we have a lot of new tools and technologies coming, we have not yet put the same amount of effort, intelligence, money into building the health systems for delivery and scale-up. We're just beginning to do that. We've done it effectively, or beginning to do it effectively, in places that have gotten specific attention. But we haven't seen that happen in broader sets of issues. And we haven't really even begun on some of the things like chronic diseases and maternal health, and mental health.
And just a follow-up question to that, and we're going to now take about 10 minutes of Q&A from the audience, so if people who have questions for this panel want to start going up, and we'll only have 10 minutes. So, but, you know, you raise an interesting issue that I think we will have to grapple with, which is, do we stick to the things that we already know we do well and continue to play with our strong suit, as you said, or is it smarter for us to think about a more integrated strategy, or looking at the things that we have not taken on or not shown the spotlight on? So, yeah, I think it's something we will have to grapple with, and maybe both of you might want to say a couple words on that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I think the smart thing to do is to avoid the either-or dichotomy, as you had said, you know, in your introductory comments. I think we have to learn from what's worked in the places where we've put the attention and made the progress, and build on that to replicate it for the areas where we have yet to make that progress or shine that light.
Yeah, and I would also add that I think the answer to that question has to be, as Chris said, the right balance. But it also has to be answered through the eyes of the stakeholders that we're trying to help. What are the greatest priorities within the country? And I think that the better we can answer that and the better we can determine where will we get the greatest support within the country to solve these problems will tell us where we can take the advances and successes that we've had and further leverage them, and where we can go for a more integrated approach, which I think we would all agree is what's needed for the ultimate success of this endeavor.
Great, thanks. And I just want to recognize Ambassador Tom Pickering, who has joined us, who is another one of our commissioners. Really pleased to have you with us. Yeah. And we'll take the first question.
Thank you. My name is Edward Kadunk. I'm the executive director of the Pan American Health and Education Foundation. I'm very heartened by the comments on a more integrated approach to health. I think the silo approach has been very effective. We've had great impact on specific diseases, but it overlooks, I think, two important factors. One is that you need to have a more attention to primary health and to an integrated health system within which these interventions are occurring. The amount of money that's being directed by governments and by foundations, these efforts really have had somewhat of a pernicious effect on human resource availability for healthcare in developing countries, because it sucks in the best personnel into these best-funded programs. And so I think we do have to think about a more integrated approach. And secondly, we make people healthy and they live longer, and then what do? They need to have economic development activities. They need to have more just society. They need to have education for their children. So health is in the context of more just and a more economically vibrant society. So that's one point I'd like to point out for your consideration. And the other is what I think is a woeful lack of attention to Latin America. Most of the efforts have gone into other areas of the world. Latin America is a place that we have cultural affinity, we have economic interests, and we also have disease concerns. And I think if this policy is about the United States, then more effort has to go into drawing attention to Latin America and to providing assistance.
Yeah, I think those are all very salient points, and I do think there's an opportunity to address all of those within our deliberations.
Thank you. My name is Gary Saffitz. I'm with Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health, and I consider myself to be a field guy. I've worked in over 20 countries on a wide range of health issues, and I guess my perspective on things really is from the bottom up, or from the countries that are really wrestling with many of the health issues we're talking about. My first comment is congratulations. The whole concept of really taking a strategic look at global health and stepping back and getting a little altitude, I think, is really the right time and the right space to be in, especially with the resources that we do have now that are available to begin to address the issues. I think it's very clear that as we come up to the mic and as you all sit there, everybody brings to the table their own perspective on things. As I look at much of what I've seen on the ground, it is not just the clinical interventions. It really is the prevention side associated with these interventions. I would hope that family planning would be very much a part of the global strategy. There's been enormous investments and enormous return on those investments, not just in improved health, maternal health, child health, and health outcomes, but the impact that comes with meeting that unmet need and allowing families to have the number of children that they can care for and its impact on health and on economic development and on poverty. I'm involved in global tobacco initiatives, and there's no question if you look at this as one of the single contributors to the disease burden around the world and one of the most preventable aspects going, that there is a place for global tobacco and chronic disease at the table. So I guess my comment is to really encourage you as collectively we work through these things to take a look not just at the immediate needs and not just at the infectious diseases, not to say it's an either or, but to recognize there's a broader palette. One of the things that we have really looked at.
In the interest of time, we have 5 minutes and five speakers, so.
My apologies.
Yes.
My apologies. The households, it all converges at the household and community level. The integrated model is very important. Thank you. My apologies.
No problem. A minute per person.
Good morning. I'm Todd Preston with Population Action International. I will be brief. Just to echo some of the comments about the importance of family planning and reproductive health and to make a plea to the commission not to ignore this issue. Pakistan is an excellent example of the importance of family planning, reproductive health, and empowering women. Pakistan's population has quadrupled since 1960. In the next 15 years, it will add the equivalent of the entire population of Iran, about 70 million people. There is large unmet need and demand for family planning in Pakistan among women there. It's obviously very much tied to overall empowerment and status and treatment of women. There's nothing in the Quran that prohibits family planning. We have great success stories in other countries around the world of Muslim nations. And when you look at the spillover effect of rapid population growth into the education sector, into the employment sector, when countries are not able to invest in youth, we all know what that means. So I would I encourage you to not ignore those issues, and congratulations again on a wonderful, wonderful effort.
Thank you. My name is James Hospedalis. I'm the coordinator for the Prevention and Control of Chronic Diseases in the Pan American Health Organization. When you ask the question, what is global health about today, I would say overwhelmingly it's about the epidemic that is not beginning but is upon us of chronic non-communicable diseases, injuries, violence, and mental health. It's about 90% of the global health burden. Maybe 10% of the resources for prevention are spent there. The evidence is clear: premature death, levels of risk factors, social determinants, preventability. We have maybe 30, 40 million people in the world with AIDS. We have 300 million people with diabetes. Over a billion people are obese or overweight. I could go on, but in view of the minute. The cost burden to governments, to families, and to companies is incredible. I was at the World Economic Forum Summit last week in Rio de Janeiro, and the health minister for Brazil spoke. And most of his speech addressed this subject of chronic non-communicable diseases, tobacco, unhealthy diet, alcohol use, and the problems related, the consequent problems of cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular. Now, we know what to do about it to a large extent, but the delivery gap, the discovery delivery gap is too long. We have too many technologies that we're not using, like cervical cancer. We have 30 million women in this hemisphere who have never been screened. A single screen cuts mortality by 30% from the ACCP work that Pat's involved in. We have 100 million people who need access to cardiovascular. Time is up. Last comment, integrate. The same system platform for HIV is the same system platform we need for chronic non-communicable diseases.
So that was a perfect lead into what I was going to say. I'm Linda Kupfer from the Fogarty International Center at the NIH. And as we talk about integration, as we talk about effective interventions, I think it's important to factor in research, scientific research, and also training. It's something that Fogarty's been involved with from the beginning, and I think it's going to be critical to really make sure that our global health efforts are effective. And in addition to that, implementation science, which recently Roger Glass told me that the reason it says implementation science in our strategic plan and not implementation research is so that no one gets scared. But the fact of the matter is it's really important to do the science and the research so that we know what we're doing and how to do it most effectively.
20 seconds. Greg Pappas, a professor of community health science at the Aga Khan University. I've worked in lots of countries for many years. Integration is important, but it's not the top thing on my agenda, having worked in the field for years. It's maybe fifth. The top is governance issues. Governance issues. Great programs, great science, all these things don't work, and they haven't worked in many, many countries. We have precious few success stories. One of the big issues is lack of failure to address issues of governance.
Yeah, could I just make a brief comment on that? I agree with that comment, and I would just reflect a moment on the Gavi experience that integration can take two forms. The broader ultimate answer, integrate everything, trying to address global health. I agree that that is not our short-term priority, but we need to get there. But even integrating all the different stakeholders involved, even in one particular area, is critical. And that's what Gavi has been able to achieve with immunization, to bring all the various stakeholders together so that when these vaccines become available, when funding is available, they can actually get them to the children and others who need them. And that, to me, is what's needed first and foremost.
Thank you very much. That was a great way to end what I think was a wonderfully spirited discussion. And each of your comments could have, brought on a range of other comments from our panelists and from others. So thank you, and appreciate you recognizing the time constraints. But we will take all of these comments into consideration, very much on point. So thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it back over to Bill Fallon.
We're going to move to our next panel. Please get to your seats.
Well, it's plain to see there's lots of enthusiasm and lots of interest and many issues and many agendas, which we knew were out there. But one of our main challenges is to get it all on the table to the best of our ability and then see what makes sense in the way of moving forward with some kind of an intelligent policy recommendation. We are really particularly blessed today to have a couple of our commissioners, a few of our commissioners up here with us, and by way of very short introductions to their phenomenally varied and impressive backgrounds. On my right is Patricia Mitchell, Pat, who is the president and CEO of the Paley Center for the Media out in L.A. right now. She's the past president and CEO of PBS. She's got a distinguished career as a correspondent, a producer. She is the media maven, underline, a lady with acknowledged decorations and accolades of a list that would stagger you. I thought that military people had long lists of decorations, but Pat's got Emmys and just many, many awards. But her real claim to fame is she knows the media business, and we need the insights that she brings. And she has been very, very willing through many years to volunteer herself to many good causes, and particularly the business of global health. So, Pat, welcome. Next to her, Dr. Michael Merson. Mike is the founding director of the Global Health Institute at Duke University down in North Carolina. He has been serving for many years with a distinguished experience in academia and in the field. He was 10 years as the first dean at public health up at Yale, and he was with the World Health Organization for many years before that. Mike, we're very, very pleased to have you with us on the commission and today. And the distinguished gentleman down at the end, no stranger to most in the audience, I suspect, Ambassador Tom Pickering, career ambassador, six times serving in other countries, including Russia and Israel and India, more than five decades of public service. I could go on and on. Now he's lending some of that experience and expertise in the business world, and he's been very, very gracious to share it with us. But his real claim to fame, I've got to tell you, is that there's a connection here. The book ends at this table. He was born in Orange, New Jersey. I was born next door in East Orange, and he's also a former naval officer, and so I think we got the place around in time. But thanks to have you here. Well, there are clearly no lack of issues, but one thing that I find seems to me to be very, very critical, and we're blessed to have Pat Mitchell here, is I'd like to talk a little bit about the communication business, how we can affect an understanding with what the commission might be about and people, the American public, and what it is that we need to understand about effective communications. Pat, could you talk to us a little bit about that? Thank you. Yes,
thank you very much, Admiral. I wondered what I was doing among this distinguished group of commissioners, and now I know I'm a media maven.
The media maven.
To be a maven of something.
But in fact, it's impossible to talk about this subject or any other without taking into account the power of the media. There's probably no other single player with such global power, and as it's become more mobile and more global, its power and influence has increased. So why not, in areas of such deep and significant concern as the issues of global health, do we not think about how to further optimize this power to the benefit of all? And I'd just like to share a couple of examples that I've been involved in and have witnessed, as I think it guides our explorations as we go forward. It's so clear, you know, you can point to some very obvious evidence of when the power of media is mobilized and is optimized, what it can do. You look at the One campaign, the Red campaign run by Bono. Celebrities have often known how to energize the media around an issue. But for the journalists working inside media companies, you know, the challenge has always been, if you didn't come to them with a global health story that fell into what I call the epidemic panic category or the Lazarus category, tell me a great success story of somebody raised from the dead, or tell me a story that's going to, you know, have my child on a bus with a TB patient. So at those two extremes, we can do pretty well in getting one off stories out into the media. But where the media now, in particular with global conglomerates controlling so much of it and with so much of the new technologies, there are all kinds of new ways to look at the power of storytelling and the power of information and start to use it. And this commission, I hope, will find new ways to do that in terms of raising awareness and spreading information. These are the two ways in which the power can be used in positive ways. In the early 2000s, we convened a conference of global media companies around the issue of HIV/AIDS in particular and said, what are you doing in your country? And they all said, well, we're doing this news report, that news report, we're spreading this pamphlet, we're giving out these brochures. And, of course, it was only reaching a certain population, the literate population and the population who was seeking information. So when the public broadcasting system in South Africa, for example, decided to put HIV/AIDS messaging inside a sports program, an entertainment program in which 80% of the population who had television or radio was listening or watching this program on a weekly basis, they could track an immediate difference in the take-up of condom use and in some of the other preventative medicines in the preventative measures in the country. So in India, they did the same thing with a public broadcasting service. And again, it's often the public media sector that takes this up because commercial media companies have to be, you have to prove to them first to make money, which, by the way, you can if they turn out to be popular enough. And in India, the single most popular soap opera, something watched religiously by so much of the population, again embedded AIDS messaging and also an HIV person into the storyline, as did Sesame Street, which you may remember, on a global basis, added one of the puppets was an HIV-positive young girl. So as these entertainment vehicles went out, people, you know, got the messages in different ways, in ways they could assimilate. But we still have another challenge. You still are not reaching often the illiterate population with the kind of messaging you need, and you're only reaching people who have radio and television by and large. So mobile technology has now opened up a whole new world for us. And in India recently, I was in a rural village where there was 90% illiteracy among the women, where maternal health is one of the single biggest health issues. And the mobile phones that are being given are sold at $10 a mobile phone by a locally owned mobile phone company, have push-out messages so that when you turn it on, the message says, if you're pregnant, you need to do this, this, and this. Are you experiencing this, this, and this? And in the language and in the dialect, these messages are communicated. And you've also see this in other countries. In Afghanistan, with the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, which I was very pleased to be a part of, one of the first efforts we did was to create an electronic game in partnership with an electronic game company, as a book that, again, for the illiterate woman, she pushed a button on pictures, and these pictures brought up messages which led her to the nearest healthcare provider or led her through a difficult breech birth. Telemedicine is also deploying the use of mobile technology. So as this commission begins its work, I think we have just so many exciting examples around the world where media is being fully optimized and deployed that we can not only document, but in doing so, we can encourage the kind of public and private partnerships that are going to be essential to make sure that media is playing the role it needs to play in resolving this huge crisis facing the world. Glad to be a part of it.
Pat, thank you very much. And Pat's going to have to run to another commitment, but as you can see, we are the great beneficiaries of someone who understands the business of communication, but more importantly, has the connection with global health. And Pat, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you in the next couple of weeks.
Thank you, Admiral.
Sure. I'd like to have Mike Merson
come. Just to add, what's driving global health, thinking about the media in this country, two points I'd briefly make. One, what's driving global health so much in this country, particularly in academia, are the youth. As David Brooks has said, today's youth have an unconsummated desire for service and sacrifice. And we see that in university after university. The faculty are having a tough time keeping up with the enthusiasm and commitment of today's students. And so much of that is driven by the media and by the students being aware of the world today and trying to make it a better world. I think the media has been critical, and we might want to think about that. And we also might want to think about how the media affects the attitude of the American public toward health globally. The best example that comes to mind I can think of right now is the global food supply. Recently, I was someone who had a glass of milk in front of them and said, well, can I drink this milk? Is it from China? And you all know that we had a terrible scare with milk coming from China. That's just one example. But I think the American public reacts very much to what's in front of it, and in terms of, you said before, particularly in terms of security, and whether it's a person with tuberculosis traveling on an airplane or someone with the SARS virus, I think that the media plays a critical role in the way the American public perceives global health threats, and we need to think about as a commission how to make the best use of that.
Mike, thanks very much. Ambassador Pickering, you are a man who has spent a lifetime engaging in the diplomacy of this nation and the world. Could I ask you for your perspectives on this business of global health and how it might fit into the greater issue of security and stability in the world?
Thank you, Admiral. I'm in danger of running on, since everybody knows diplomats get paid by the word. But let me just say two or three things. One wonders what a former diplomat's doing talking about health, other than the personal interest, which is extreme. I had the pleasure of being Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science, and health was an important part of our consideration some years ago, and recently have been part of a co-chair team of an Institute of Medicine study on global health with Harold Varmus, whom many of you know of if you do not know. The study has produced a letter report for the new administration, and it will produce its final report at the end of this month or the beginning of next month. The report itself is an effort to bring together a number of international commissioners with some Americans. And much of what I heard in the last panel is, in a sense, what informed us as being wise. Integrated systems, attention to non-communicable diseases, accidents, and indeed non-traditional diseases and some of the minority diseases in the communicable world and the tropical world. A sense that America's great strength rests in its ability to do better, more productive, and more useful research in a serious focus on that, some of which we heard in the discussions of the under-researched, under-attended to disease problems. I think that we did a fair amount of work on trying to help the United States government think through and organize itself. The need for someone very seriously well-placed in the National Security Council to deal with health, not just as a bio-warfare threat problem, but because it, in effect, runs across the whole national ability to have a healthy and strong and stable population. A very strong sense that the World Health Organization has done a good job but could do an awful lot better job. Struggle with the notion that we should put more money to global health, and some serious recognition that PEPFAR has taken us a long way toward the Millennium Development Goals, but that we have a great deal more to do, that PEPFAR has established some delivery structures that might be built upon and integrated with as we go ahead. A very strong sense that the United States should be taking, again, the lead in global health. And that one idea we had was that the president might call a global health summit in the autumn at the United Nations. There will be a G20 summit, so how those two might be integrated is an interesting challenge. And I have thought that it is probably useful if you have a summit on global health to consider problems of food and nutrition and certainly water, which are intimately and closely related to the challenges and have us obviously deal with the underlying deep problems of poverty, growth, and development around the world, and health's particularly important and intrinsic role in dealing with that set of issues. So that, in brief, compasses what we have been occupied with, and I look forward, obviously, to our conversation, and thank you.
Great, Tom. Thanks very much. We'll have one more opportunity. If you have any questions for this particular panel or comments, go ahead and make your way to the mic if you care to exercise your minute or so. Please, sir.
Mike McDonald, Global Health Initiatives. I just got back from WHO studying the impact of global health initiatives on health system strengthening. And clearly the message today is that we're going in the right direction, and there are expectations that we can continue that momentum. I see this panel in an interesting way. You also represent perhaps the connection between health and human security, and I would put out a concern, an observation of 30 years of research on this, that we may have some discontinuities coming in the years ahead, not just economic discontinuities, but if you look at the G8's reflection on our current food crisis, for example, we may need to use a new science base, a new technology base to address problems in ways that tie health to the socioecological conditions. We may be in a circumstance where there are collapses of ecosystems and the concomitant effect, like in Darfur. So I'd like to see if you'd like to comment on the connection between human security and health, and if you think it would be prudent for this commission to look at the possibility of discontinuities and what we could do to face those issues in a more anticipatory fashion. Thank you.
Ambassador, would you like to take a shot at that one?
Yes, I certainly think you make a point that is real and genuine and ought to be looked at. I see, obviously, health as a major factor, not just in individual preoccupations, but in social systems. And obviously, the unwinding, if you can put it that way, of traditional and non-traditional societies and modern societies as a result of an inability to deal with an onslaught of or rapid changes in the health picture are clearly things that need to be looked at. I also think that in a systematic way, one has to look, as I said a moment ago, at food and water as major contributors and major concomitants of good global health as we go around. My feeling is as a system that obviously funding is a critical lubricant to moving a lot of these particular processes forward. So is technology. So are dedicated people. So is good organization. Governance, as a gentleman said here a while ago, and so is a stress, if I could put it this way, on local planning and local strategies and local success, because obviously the ability of a social system to accept what I would call the good health offering depends a lot on being able to understand it. So I totally agree with you, and I think that one has to look at these from a system point of view as much as one looks at these from an individual point of view.
Thank you. Sir?
Yeah, I'm Charles Teller, visiting scholar at the Population Reference Bureau, and I'm going to make a plea for the use of evaluation research to understand what is working and often what is not working in a more integrated approach. I'm a field person with more than 40 years living in these poorest third world countries and teach and do evaluation research. Just came back from a conference in Cairo on experts in impact evaluation, and it was clear, it was a consensus, that we really know very little about what is working. We know the propaganda, but we don't know what is really working. And the consensus was that we need more case studies. We need to take a more holistic approach. We can't generalize about Africa. We can't generalize about Central Asia. These often is a country-by-country situational analyses that we need, and to develop indigenous capacity to understand, to monitor progress. We need to integrate the MDGs, integrate MDG 1, poverty and hunger, and education, number 2, and water, with the other 3, 4, and 5. That's the type of integrated and case study approach that we need to understand what's working and often what's not working.
Really, really good point. Thanks. Mike, anything you want to comment on? No. Sir.
Len Rubenstein, U.S. Institute of Peace. Throughout the discussion, there have been occasional references to security, and it relates both to policy and to marketing. We know, and CSIS has done really good work on this, there are some connections between health and national security. But there's also a temptation in trying to get more money, more policy attention, to say all health is about national security. And then someone says, well, it's human security, which is really quite different. That's about the intrinsic value of health. But I just think it would be very helpful if the commission could sort this out and really make distinctions between when, from a realistic empirical basis, one can say national security is at stake, and not fall into the trap of trying to persuade policymakers that it's all national security. We give up our values about intrinsic value of health, and we're on very thin ice from an evidence standpoint.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the input. We'll endeavor to pay attention to that. And go ahead, Mike.
Just one quick comment. I think the economic situation, though, that we're in now around the world, really does make us even more imperative that we consider the security question. When you think of 90 million more people going into poverty, another 500,000 children going to die in the next few years, mothers and children we know are going to suffer the most in countries. There's going to be less foreign aid. There's going to be less money available from governments themselves for their people. There's going to be less out-of-pocket expenses. There's going to be serious economic problems, and they really are going to be a threat to security.
Great.
Hello. My name is Sue Partridge. I'm from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. I want to thank you for this meeting. I think it's long overdue. I and CDC have been participating in the non-proliferation end of of global public health capacity building. And I think for many years we've noted that building infrastructure that only looks at dangerous pathogens or for the U.S. select agents for both humans and animals is not enough. You have to have a system that's comprehensively looking at public health, that's looking at not only the dangerous pathogens, but the things that matter the most to the countries, period. And that oftentimes is infectious disease. It may also be chronic disease, and basically the full breadth. As you're putting this, as you and the commission are meeting onward, I would like to make a couple comments. One, there is some infrastructure that's being built, and there is the basis of a system that's being built by the USG. And this includes DOD, it includes HHS, it also includes agricultural on a peripheral level in the former Soviet Union. There's been a lot of money that's gone there, and they've done a lot of good things. And there are ways that we should better improve what we've done. I think that your comments, Mr. Ambassador, are completely dead on. We need a summit to define what global health is, global public health, or global public health security. We need to have the stakeholders come together to define what it is and to define where their lanes are and how they overlap and how we can put together a system that is well enough funded to actually make a difference. I would hope that might be connected in with the WHO 2005 revised international health regulations. And I hope that all of the interagency is actually invited to participate. I'm a little sad to see that some of my colleagues from the nonproliferation world aren't here.
Okay, we're going to have to move along. Thanks for the input. Yeah. We have the net casting wide here. You're in, Captain?
Yes.
And then get the uniforms here at the end.
Daniel Miller, I'm director of the International Influenza Unit at HHS. Just bringing together two pieces of information, some of the background material for today, as well as some of the discussion related to the need for integration of programs, as well as finding the right balance between multilateral and bilateral support and development assistance. One of the other key issues that we've been facing in avian and pandemic influenza preparedness is coordination of the donors, that is a major headache. We have comparative advantages, other countries have comparative advantages, and there's not a proper forum, as much as WHO would like to be that proper forum, it frequently doesn't act as the proper forum to be able to do that. So that's something else for consideration.
Thanks. And the final comments.
I'll round out the public health service trifecta. I just wanted to ask the Commission, as you move forward, to focus on identifying the appropriate in-country partners for these programs. The Congressman earlier today talked about the need to move beyond this relationship of sort of a patron and a client. And the problem that we've consistently found in all of the programs that we've worked on is that oftentimes the U.S. steps up with more resources and more organization than the host country is willing to put towards it. If you look at the commitment by the African Union to put 15% of their national budgets towards health, almost no countries have met that goal. And the question that we consistently face as we try to sell our programs to the U.S. taxpayers is, why should we make these investments in countries when those countries themselves aren't willing to make similar investments? So finding a way to establish the right partners, to leverage the governance, which we heard about earlier, of these countries to create the right place to have the absorptive capacity for our programs, I think is critical. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Good point. Okay, I think we've got ourselves almost to the point where we'd like to be time-wise. I'd like to thank our distinguished panel members for their participation, ask them if they care to.
One brief point. A number of you discussed the Millennium Development Goals. My view is that the outcome of a summit could not only be a clear definition and indeed some important principles and guidelines for further development of dealing with global health, but I would hope that the United States, which is in reach in 4, 5, and 6 of meeting its global commitment to the Millennium Development Goals, could going into that summit also, given the administration's increase in foreign assistance, take the rest of the world further in the direction of meeting the Millennium Development Goals, which cut across, obviously, global health as well as a lot of other objectives that are of significance and importance to us all.
Okay, we'll reset here for the final minute or two.
Yeah, thanks. Bill and I are supposed to kind of give a wrap-up. There's no way to give a wrap-up. This has been such a rich discussion, too. We only have about a minute left. But I would just say, again, we really value the comments that people have made. I think that there are lots of things that are right on target, both in terms of specific content, but also in terms of some of the tensions and the things that we're going to have to grapple with. So I thank you all for your incredible input. Please continue to go to, we have a website, which is the globalhealthpolicycenter.org. Oh, CSIS, and then, yeah, CSIS.org, and then go to the Global Policy Center portion of it. We will continue to post the papers that are going to be the basis of our deliberations, and we really look forward to continuing to have a dialogue with many of you in this room, and we, again, appreciate you giving your time and your experience to this process. We look forward to this being a very rich experience. We have two meetings, one in June and one in October, and then we will be putting out the report. So we really look forward to this process, and thank you all very much for your participation. And I want to, again, thank the panelists for their great inputs. Brief though they were, I think it really helped to bring a lot of these issues together and give us food for thought. So thank you.
How to add much to this except to invite you to just take away a couple of points. One, the very, very large turnout today is indicative to me of a very, very broad interest in this subject. Two, the level of expertise and breadth of knowledge that our commissioners bring, as you have seen from their very short appearances here on panels, is a testament to the good work here of the folks at CSIS for beating the bushes and trying to make the best talent available. And the third point is just from the comments of not only the commissioners, but from the many in the audience who helped to participate and bring to our attention the very, very broad range of issues that have to be considered in this subject that the panel's undertaking. So there's no lack of work. I've taken a lot of notes. There are scribes that have duly written down the things that you have brought to our attention. We'll look forward to continuing to hear from you. And thanks for your kind attention today, and to the CSIS gang, Steve, and your team, Lisa, and all the folks that made this possible, our appreciation. Thanks. A pleasure to be with you.